Hey, welcome everybody. Welcome to the Winning Momentum Podcast with your host. That's me, Scott Sinclair. I have a good friend of mine here with us today. I think you're going to enjoy this. Jeffrey Hiscock. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's an absolute privilege, and I appreciate you inviting me onto your show, onto your podcast. It's fantastic.
Jeff is one of my favorite Bay Street guys. Now, Jeff, you may not know that a significant percentage of our audience is American. And so Bay Street, as I've said to you guys before, is like the Canadian Wall Street or Midtown Manhattan. It's where all the financial district is. And Jeff's been around there a long time, maybe 20, 25 years, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, 25 years I've been on the street. So I happened into asset-based lending, Scott, technically by accident. So what had happened was I attended university in Kingston. I went to Queen's University, graduated, and like some other folks, we don't really know what we're going to do when we've got a, you know, when I've graduated with a BSc and a BA, and I originally wanted to go to med school, and I thought, hey, you know what? I mean, I'm not going to cut it out for that. So, you know, I wanted to look to the business world, and so I took my CPH and my CSC while I was at Queen's in fourth year, and that was fun. I thought I maybe wanted to get into securities, into swapping securities and whatnot, and so I've always been a new business guy. I'm a social person.
Yeah.
At heart. So having said that, I started out in a factoring firm, worked there for 10 months. It was great. There was a gentleman that had sublet space from us who actually worked for Great American. To all our excellent US friends. And his name was Fred Metter. And Fred was a really great mentor to me and said, hey, Jeff, it's not bad what you're doing, but we've talked quite a bit and I see that you're a little more interested in getting a little more into the weeds and really this type of finance. And I said, absolutely. So he introduced me to Stephen Smith and to who's with Meridian now, and Wayne Eggetts, who's my CEO and boss. It was like serendipity. So I worked with Congress Financial for 7 years, made my way over to CITC, and then in 2010 went to PNC Credit.
Let me jump into those before you get too far ahead. So,
absolutely, Scott.
Yeah, 25 years. I think I met you. When I met you, you were at PNC, which was probably 10, 12
that
years ago at a former sushi restaurant by the name of Katana in Toronto.
Yeah, on Bay Street.
That didn't survive COVID. I love that restaurant. And so for the audience here, and I'm going to just bear with me, Jeff, because I'm going to, we have a lot of non-financial people on here
and
that listen to the Winning Momentum podcast. One of the things that I had to learn over 3 years of doing content, you'll appreciate this, Jeff, is that there's a whole other world out there that has no idea what we're talking about sometimes. The lessons, are important, but sometimes the language doesn't work. So Jeff is a senior executive originator and innovative financial architect of commercial loans for both private and publicly held companies. You have an extensive background in structuring, negotiating, executing multinational asset-based lending and commercial realty transactions, as well as additional debt capital solutions across the capital structure. Here's where I'm going to take a time out for the audience, because I get this complaint. Not a complaint. I get this recommendation a lot. And I'm going to remind you from the Winning Momentum podcast to the audience that when we think about the financial structure of a business, of a company, if we think about a balance sheet, which you've heard of before, on the balance sheet, on the right-hand side, there's really two things. There's debt, broadly speaking, and there's equity. Debt is money you have to pay back. Equity is money you don't have to pay back. Maybe someday you've got to redeem it and people need to get out. But that's the difference between debt and equity. And debt divides into, I'm always telling you, if you listen to the content, into secured debt and unsecured debt. And secured means that it has first picking at the assets when something goes wrong. And unsecured gets what's ever left over, right? That's what secured versus unsecured is. And secured debt, in turn, could divide into a first lien and a second lien. In other words, there's a ranking within the secured charges. Who comes first? I always call it the pecking order, if you want to go back and listen to some of the content. And what Jeff does is mostly that first lien, first secured, normal bank stuff, which can be covered off with different types of products. But generally what you're doing is you're lending on accounts receivable, inventory, equipment, and real estate. And that's pretty much it, right? And I know that's not it, but it's pretty much it.
And Scott, you hit the nail on the head. Absolutely.
Okay.
So again, from a senior secured position, Scott, you characterized everything perfectly. And as you said, I mean, primarily we're into working capital, providing revolving lines as well as term loans against machinery, equipment, other fixed assets, immovable properties such as commercial real estate, whatnot. And Scott, that's the gist of what we do on the balance sheet.
And again, just for the context for the audience, then asset-based lending is just one of those products that does the same thing. And it is a way for a lender to try to give you more money by doing more evaluation of those specific assets. It's just a product. It comes with complexities from the borrower's perspective. There's a lot more reporting. It might be a tad more expensive because everybody's got to monitor this thing and hire professionals. But the bottom line is that's my favorite product for what I do for a living and helping troubled businesses. If you're in a high growth or transitionary situation as a business owner and you've got some assets, ABL is probably the right product for you.
That's absolutely correct, Scott. So, I mean, like typically like ourselves and what we do, we're non-traditional. So when I say non-traditional, what I mean by that is we're non-traditional as compared to the banks. So we've got the big five up here, the big five banks, and then we've obviously got some SCED 2s and whatnot. And then down in the United States, there's a myriad of different banking institutions, and then there's private credit lenders down in the United States as well as in Canada. And that's what I represent. So from a non-traditional point of view, typically you are paying a little more of a rate on what we're doing with the balance sheet, because Scott, what we're tending to do as you've worked with us is we try to take the balance sheet and squeeze as much of that lemon as possible, squeeze as much juice out of it to get as much leverage for the company or the entrepreneur, private, public company, in order to drive their working capital and their general corporate needs during a distress time, during a growth period, whereby a traditional institution would have you bound by really ring fencing you in with covenants and whatnot. We're highly covenant-like. So, yeah, for example, like a company might have negative EBITDA. I'll look for interest payments every month. But you know what? I'm not looking for a pay down on my revolver like you would do normally on a term loan. Yeah. And from a leverage point of view, company's got $2 million in EBITDA. You want a $15 million line? You want a $20 million line? It's yours.
Right. Because there's no principal payments. And that's, we're going to come to that towards the end of this, I think.
Okay.
Because perfect. I think that's, if you're trying to move your business from here to there, you need capital to do it. Availability is everything, in my view. Okay. So, Jeff, you're currently at Wagar Capital in Toronto.
Yes.
And you have previously been with other significant firms like Frontwell, BDC, which is the Business Development Bank of Canada.
Correct.
PNC. Didn't they sell to somebody? They're not PNC anymore, are they?
So,
or maybe they still PNC. Fifth West, I think, or Fifth.
No, they're still cooking around. PNC Business Credit is still cooking. And actually, Scott, it was, I had a lot of there was a lot of different stages in my career. Congress, I really learned the nuts and bolts, the ABCs of what. Yep. What we do, and it was my first real job, really, and working in a boutique similar to Wagar, what I'm working in now, that atmosphere of, you're not a number,
you're not a significant bank, you're more entrepreneurial.
You're way entrepreneurial. And that's why folks like yourself and ourselves, we get along very well.
Yep.
And we know how to pivot properly with entrepreneurs and everybody else. So,
well, that's kind of where I'm heading with this, because you know, you worked at BDC, is a Crown Corporation in Canada. PNC is a significant mid-market bank in the U.S. You are at CIT Business Credit, which is now CIBC, Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, one of the top handful of Canadian banks. That's massive in size. And Wachovia, which otherwise known as Wells Fargo right now, another massive financial institution. So you've done both the smaller boutique entrepreneurial, and you have had a legit banking business career. And one of the things I didn't know about you, Jeff, even though we know each other so well, is I didn't realize that you were originally a collateral analyst and underwriter, because I think of you as an originator. I think of you as an originator who knows what you're doing, as to distinguish from a number. Well, because, and that's one of the things I want to talk to you about is, and we're going to get there, not right now, but how much does it help in your sales job to actually know the product? Because you've underwritten the product, right? And underwriting, for those of you that don't know, is, you know, you're the person reviewing the risk, doing the due diligence, writing up the credit memos within the bank. And so, you know, someone else is bringing you that deal often, and you're the one that has to do the hard work on it.
You know? That is correct. So I started out, when I started out at Congress, I actually was hired as an analyst, a collateral analyst. And for those of you that don't know that, like that role, basically, you're the front line. You're the front line of defense, both on the portfolio side and then also on the new business side. For whatever new business, like a guy like myself now needs for the collateral analyst to look at. And generally, you're looking at balance sheet items. So accounts receivable, subledgers, inventory perpetuals, AP, accrued liabilities and whatnot. And you're just basically on, like, for the most part, you're really supporting a loan officer or a relationship manager that has a relationship with an existing client within the institution. And you're basically the first defense. So when you get the information in on a monthly basis or weekly basis or whatever have you not, whatever is dictated or prescribed in the financing agreement, and you're there to basically look at the trends, the collateral trends, monitor what's going on, do some collateral testing to ensure that, you know, what you're lending on is actually there. So, for example, accounts receivable and inventory and whatnot. Generally, we rely on third-party field examiners for that. But for that most part, I started in that position. And at Congress, they were kind enough to catapult me into a loan officer position. Typically, the trajectory in what we do is you start out as an analyst, learn that sort of collateral role and what you're limited to. Then you'll typically go to a field exam position where you're getting you're basically getting a 3D picture of what you're looking at. So you're actually going to the client and you're doing a collateral field exam. So you're doing test counts on inventory. You're doing verification calls on accounts receivable that it's there. Gross profit test, gross margin test. You're basically kicking the, you know, like crossing your T's, dotting your I's on behalf of the lender to ensure that what's being reported to you is valid. True. So you typically go into that. What Wayne Eggetts did for me was he recognized earlier on that being a little bit of a social animal, he recognized me, thought, you know, I think he'll be a good sales guy, but he's got to learn the business, which I had to learn the business. So it might kill him to put him into field exam because he's going to be on the road 5 days a week and away from, you know, from whatever else is going on and everything else. We really want to focus on, you know, Jeff can go out on the road maybe once a quarter to go see clients and get that third dimension of what's happening. Right. But we really want him on the ground and working with the portfolio manager, who was Harry Rosenfeld at the time, who's very near and dear to my heart. And Harry really taught me, you know, from a street point of view, how to deal with troubled credits.
Yep.
And that's really how I grew as a risk loan, like risk adverse loan officer in that position, or relationship manager.
So,
and then into an underwriting role.
So some of our audience is, are young professionals, people getting into the industry. and into the finance industry. And we have a number of students in finance as well that listen to us. And
that's great. I love it.
Yeah, I think one of the values in our conversation can be you start to touch on how you got into the business, graduating from a sciences degree at first, I believe. And,
yeah.
Right. And then, and also 20, 25 years in banking is not the norm at all. And so you survived this and somehow. So could you talk about that for a little bit? What advice do you give students and young bankers about the career?
I love that you're asking me that, Scott. It's so brilliant. I love you have some really great young listeners here too, as well, that are looking to get into finance, and depending on whatever it is. And by all means, anybody, you can look me up on LinkedIn and reach out. I'm readily available. And I love doing that. So, and that's why I'm glad you asked, Scott, because on my LinkedIn profile, for example, I'm open to mentoring people. And you say, well, you know, some people aren't open to that. I am. I very much love meeting with younger people. Whether they're students, in the middle of, they could be in a commerce degree, a business degree, or whatever have you, and it's through friends or family, or they just reach out through LinkedIn, or it's people that may be at a different financial institution, a larger financial institution, or a private institution, and they're looking to get more into a boutique private lending shop. They see what my trajectory and what I've done, and they want to gravitate towards that. So. You know, one of the big things I did, Scott, which is interesting, which I don't know, you might know, I might have talked to you about it a little bit before, but what I found really interesting was I was a little bit introverted, to be quite honest with you, when I started out. While I was a social guy, you put me in a room, Scott, when I was, call it 25, you put me in a room and stick me in the room and with 100 people. It was very difficult for me to maneuver around that room.
I'm and the you worst know what? Still to this day, I'm terrible.
Scott, and honestly, and I'm not afraid to say it. And I do, and what's important for listeners to understand too as well, just so they understand that. And Wayne knows this. I mean, and a lot of folks do, people close to me, but I have general anxiety disorder. So, you know, having to work with that and deal and cognitively deal with that was something that really scared me. So what did I do to overcome that was I joined Second City. So really? I joined Second City Improv in 2009 and I studied there for 2 years. So I did all my improvisational courses and then a master's in improv, and I took stand up too as well. And I'm not a good comedian. So I abandoned that, but I faced my demons. And those demons were basically, you know what, it's just getting out in front of people and the lights are on you and the show is on. And yeah. you got to be able to talk. You got to be able to perform and you have to know what you're talking about. And so, Scott, I largely faced my fears by joining Second City for my business development career. That's basically how I started doing that. And then when I get into a room full of people now, you know, you walk in with a smile. And you have to look at the room as every single door is open when you walk into that room. Oh. You walk into the room, you know what, and you come in and people feel that energy, you know what, when you walk in, or you walk in and you're not smiling or you've got an ego or whatnot, and immediately you can hear the doors just start closing. You know, so I mean, yeah. That's what I found is very important for me is just, you know, put a smile on my face and, you know what? And look, but be, you know what? Be strategic about talking to folks at a cocktail function. Like, don't interrupt people, but, you know, make eye contact and make eye contact with you and boom, you're in and just start talking away and introduce yourself and away you go. And you know what? And it's always important for me, for what I've done, Scott, what I pride myself on is being positive, and looking at things in a positive manner, particularly transactions. And being enthusiastic about what I do, because I am enthusiastic about what I do. I'm a deal junkie.
Were you always like that, or was that part of your Second City experience?
It was something, honest to God, Scott, it was something that I matured into, that I grew into. I always looked up to the salespeople, the business development people that that I worked with, that where I was junior to or akin to. And I always looked up to them, and I always, you know, would ask them questions about how what they did. But it wasn't something until I started actually getting traction with folks. And I was always told, you know, like when I worked at a couple different institutions, which I shall remain nameless, you know, Jeff, you're too, you know what, you're too excited. You're too enthusiastic. You're too this. And I'm not going to change my ways the way that I am, Scott, the person that I am. You know what? I'm a polite, professional, friendly person, and I'm going to treat everybody exactly the same way that I like to be treated. And so that's what's been important for me during my career is, especially when you're speaking to folks or you're communicating with folks in any way, whether it's written, spoken or whatnot, you have to present yourself in a professional manner, and you have to add value in order to grab people's attention. Exactly. So coming back to that evolution of me being excited about deals and being a deal junkie, you know, once I started getting that positive reinforcement back that, yeah, Jeff, you know what, from both, you know, both where I work and then from the client, from the prospective client, saying, you know what, you've done a great job here, you know what, in terms of this, and then it gives you more confidence, and then you really start, you know, I got to be honest with you, it really gets me going. Like, I love anybody you talk to. I mean,
which
you know
has
what,
kept
that knows
you in
me,
the
like,
business so long, I assume.
Is that absolutely, because I've had opportunities, you know what, to do different things, whether it was to get into acting, which is a tough haul, as we all know, or getting, you know what, or
I feel like we talked about that at some dinner, maybe a Wiseman wine dinner, and you were saying, I'm out, I'm gonna go acting.
I love David Wiseman's, his dinners are fantastic and his barbecues are fantastic. Yeah. So, I mean, that was something, Scott, that I thought about and everything else, but, you know, and I've always had, like, you know, particularly when I was at CIT Business Credit, which is now CIBC, as you pointed out, asset-based, one of, if not the leading asset-based lender on the Canadian street right now. Having said that, you know, I had a few good mentors over there. And one gentleman in particular, Rick Lomas, who's the deputy CEO, and he'd say to me, Jeff, you know, like, you're really good at what you do. Like, it, you know, I was on the underwriting side at the time, and, you know, you're great with prospective clients. Like, we love that. And we don't want, you know what, and we want that. But at the same time, like, you're so much more interested in kind of arts and contemporary arts and acting and all doing all these other things. So, you know, I explored it a little bit, Scott, but at the end of the day, I had to come home, you know what, to what I really know and what I really love.
Yeah.
And that's really senior secured lending. Yeah. You know what? And developing relationships. I love talking to people. I love forming new relationships and nurturing those relationships. And that really drives me.
Let's come back to this idea that you're really good at what you do, because I think this ties into young professionals, people starting out in their careers. You have a lot of peers in your business.
Yes, sir.
Origination, business development people throughout the banks in the U.S. and Canada, and maybe more so in the U.S., but these people have no idea what they're doing whatsoever.
No idea. Some don't.
A lot of them. And maybe that's okay. I don't know. That's the question I'm having. Like, but their job is to get balls in the air and to hand them over to the next person. Hand them over to the next gal or guy. And maybe just start that funnel. But I personally, as an advisor to companies, which is part of my role, and, you know, for 30 years, is, you know, that's what you've known me as opposed to a principal.
I have, absolutely.
And I don't want to deal with those people. What I want to do is call an underwriter and bounce some ideas around and know what's going to work. Right? No, it's going to work and not going to work. And so is part of the advice that you would give a young banker or a young professional to, no matter what your opportunities are, to just find a way to know what the hell you're talking about, to continuously improve and learn in the nuts Absolutely. And bolts of your product, the science of your product, the art of your product, rather than just being better at sales.
Absolutely, Scott. So, I mean, that's number one is knowledge, right? Knowledge is king. I mean, king, queen, whatever you want to call it, over everything. So, I mean, having knowledge is superior. So, I mean, you know, one thing, Scott, that I have done is, and I continue to work on it, is active listening. So, I've always been sort of an active talker, not an active listener. So, I mean, like that's something that I'm beginning to do now. And it also, but I've always actively observed. So I watch, you know, what's happening with my peers, whether I'm working with them or whether they're in my industry and I hear tids and bits and what's going on and everything else. But being observant too and understanding of the culture and what you know, of the credit culture, what's going on in your institution, understanding, like pick up a financing agreement, read through a financing agreement, understand a borrowing base for our listeners. Scott, as you would say, it is basically it's a collateral. It's basically a ledger of the collateral that's eligible and
it lists out those assets we talked about. It says my accounts receivable are $100, and my inventory is $100, and my equipment's $1,000, and you're going to lend me 80%, 75%, and 60% on the like that. So it just calculates how much you're allowed to borrow, basically. Right.
But Scott, you hit the nail on the head in terms of knowledge, because I mean, you have to know what you're talking about. So for example, this morning, I was on the phone with a wonderful gentleman out of Mississauga. And he owns a company, entrepreneur at heart, which I love. And I love the public co's too as well, but very entrepreneurial gentleman. Built the business underneath a very large public business. And then they divested of it. He bought it and took it over anyway. So I'm talking to him and he said to me, you know, it was interesting because it was a bifurcated transaction. So they've got a slug of sub debt and then they have no senior right now. They don't have a senior operator. Okay. And so, I started talking to him and I said, look, you've got the asset, you've got enough assets that I can leverage up and take out the slug of sub debt. And then also give you an operating line to do what you're doing. But I'm talking to him. And as I'm talking to him, we're talking about, hey, you're a manufacturer. You've got inventory on the water. You've got, you know, coming over on the water. You've got inventory here, whether it's raw material, WIP, finished goods, da, da, da. And I'm talking to him about turns of inventory and accounts receivable. I'm talking to him like an underwriter would.
Right.
And this gentleman's just like saying to me, like, I want to work with you. Like, yeah. I want to, you know, and I'm saying to him, well, you know, Mr. So-and-so, I've introduced you also to this institution and this other institution too as well, which, again, you know, somebody would say to me, Jeff, why are you farming out? You know, somebody's come to you with a transaction and you're introducing them to other people. Well, I'm giving them options because at the end of the day, if he doesn't want to take out the sub debt, which is with a great player, by the way, and it's there. The pricing is pretty decent on it. If he doesn't want to do that and upset the apple cart and just work on the revolver, these other folks will help him out with that. And then you can get a better blended cost of funds down. But when I started talking to him about cost of funds and the knowledge and what we're doing, he said, you know what? He said, Jeff, I don't mind paying an extra 100 to 200 basis points if we're going to be working with folks like yourself.
Yep.
That are a patient lender and that understand what you're doing, as opposed to just a salesperson, you know, who's selling a product. An asset-based is a product. Exactly what you said, Scott, at the beginning. It's a product. It's a commodity. Largely, most of the banks have them now, have silos. There's lots of private. United States, it's massive, the liquidity there. So you have to be cognizant and understand exactly what you're selling, because I'm talking to this guy about his balance sheet, and then I'm saying to him, well, hey, this is your product. As an example, you have intellectual property, you've got trademarks.
Yep.
Now, having said that, and that gets more into the exotic collateral, you know, have you licensed? Have you you know, license any of your products out, like put your name, your brand name on, whether it be optical fragrances, this and that, and you've got a royalty stream coming in. If you've got a royalty stream coming in, I can start looking at your IP. Sadly, they did. But having said that, you know, when you start peeling the onion on the balance sheet on that and what they do in the business, and you go sort of from start to finish, it really gives the entrepreneur or the prospective borrower an idea of what you're all about and what you're driving at and what you want to do. And it also signals to them, you know what you're talking about.
That last point, I mean, the applicable part of this, I think, to anybody in any sales of any product, even outside the financial business, is that a buyer is looking to evaluate what you're offering based on the product, based on their comfort and reputation in the company, in the firm that you represent, and you. And they're looking at all three of those metrics on both an intellectual, can I explain this to my colleague, basis, and an emotional basis, right? So there's six metrics. I stole that from The Wolf of Wall Street. If everybody wants to go and buy that book, though I forget what it's called. I don't see it on my bookshelf here, The Way of the Wolf. Anyways, that's his. So just full disclosure to Jordan on that. Yep. But what you're doing is you're demonstrating you're already a good guy. So people are going to like you. So the emotional side you've got, but you're demonstrating your knowledge when you're doing that. And you're demonstrating the flexibility, understanding of the products that you're offering to find solutions, right? And so any salesperson in any industry can take those lessons. And the reason I started this conversation, Jeff, is because I don't know what you see. You're probably too kind of a person to mention it. But to me, there are many in your business that think it's about drinks and golf.
Oh, most certainly. That's most certainly the case. So, I mean, you know, I mean, and that is, you know, when everybody loves to have fun, right? And I love to have fun too as well. But I mean, you gotta work hard and, you know, have fun after, right? I mean, the way that I look at it. And the other thing you saw too as well that I'd mention is with a good salesperson, you know, is I've developed courage. And so courage is extremely important, Scott, especially for conflict and confrontational aspects of what happens. So, for example, I'm looking at a transaction and someone calls me up and says, Jeff, we're looking at doing such and such and everything else. And then I start picking it apart and do whatever I do. And I'm constantly writing things down. And I'm thinking about liquidity. Because liquidity is gold for the company, right? Like how it's going to basically, it needs the capital to run, as you pointed out at the beginning, right? So, you know, you start to get into it. And then what you'll do is you wish list, you put out what we call a wish list or request for due diligence materials. And it's an ownership, you know what, ask for their ownership chart. I want to see the whole thing, you know, a few years of review engagement or audited financial statements and so on and so forth, and internal financial statements, comparatives and whatnot, and everything else. You start looking at that, and then you start uncovering things. And so, for example, you could be looking at the ownership chart, and I draw this real example, and I was dealing with a capital advisory shop, a very large capital advisory shop, that's global, okay? And so I start looking at the ownership chart, and I go, okay.
Does it rhyme with? I won't ask.
and I start looking at, and they're great, by the way, but and it's not their fault. But I start looking then at, I'm looking at the audited financial statements, and I'm seeing intercompany related company loans going back and forth, and I'm like, where is that? Where's this company on the ownership chart?
Yeah.
It's not really that significant. And it is significant. I mean, it's on the balance sheet. I mean, this company owes the other company $2 million. It's material. So put it on there. What do they do? Well, it's a payroll. It's a payroll company. Well, I want to see the financial. I want to see the financial statements, even if they're noticed to reader on the payroll company. Well, okay. Well, we'll talk to the company. You know, they come back. Oh, they're not available. And I said, well, then, you know, unfortunately, we're not moving forward with the transaction. Like, I mean, I've signed an NDA.
How often does that sort of thing happen?
It happens very, for me to find another company on an ownership chart, Scott, which would take me and you like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Probably happens probably 30%. I'd say a third of the time that happens.
Oh, but not even another company off the chart, but just something that's painfully obvious. But the company or the advisor hasn't highlighted it, hasn't dealt with it, doesn't have an answer.
That was the first time that I've dealt with that in that particular occasion.
Really?
Yeah. And lo and behold, the company had to file because they weren't remitting their payroll taxes to the government.
Ouch.
And as such, that's why they didn't want me to see what was going on with the financials for that business. So, and they didn't want me to see the accrued liabilities ledger either. So, I mean, you know, those are the things that, you know, that, like, again, those are the things that scare me, right? Like, you have a gut instinct. And on your last podcast, we talked about this briefly with John Robertson, who was such an incredible podcast.
Thank you.
Again, I loved it. But, you know, talking about that, you know, cognitive dissonance, you know, and you start wrestling with yourself and you're like, you know, you're trying to, but at the end of the day, it's in black and white, right? So, I mean, that doesn't, it's probably a third of the time in terms of just leaving, you know, they forget to put in different companies or hold codes or trust codes. And again, you know what, Scott, I'm not a suspicious person, or I'm not like, oh, what are you doing, right? Like, you left that off on purpose. It's just, you know, hey, it's just a deck that hasn't been updated or whatever have you, right? So you run into that. But
let's dive into that point, though. I mean, and I'm jumping way ahead here, but that's cool. The due diligence is the art of just looking for red flags, right? And then
it is. It really is.
How do you juggle the need to get assets on the books to close a deal versus the integrity of what you just described?
Well, integrity is everything. So for me, it's not difficult, Scott, as a person. I don't have that. And I've seen it happen, and we'll talk about this in a second, but I've seen business development people or officers do some really not up to snuff things.
Yeah.
And having said that, that's just not in my DNA. So I don't have that, you know, I don't have that itch that I need to scratch. So I'm lucky, I'm fortunate enough that I don't have that in my DNA. So integrity is everything. So when I'm looking at a transaction, and it's difficult, Scott, because sometimes you get into a transaction and things are going really well, and like due diligence is great, the field exam came out well, everything is sort of jiving, and then all of a sudden the company has a hiccup and things start to weave back and forth. Then now you're getting a real look at how the company behaves under extreme pressure. I mean, they're dealing with the financing on this side, and then they're dealing with, you know, with the loss of multiple customers or whatever have you, or a pandemic or whatever has occurred, right?
And the personal stress that comes along with that in
correct
that person's you, life, right? Like there's personal guarantees, there's they're not buying the new car at home. They're taking out the stress on their family. I mean, it's a difficult, difficult thing. And it forces lots of entrepreneurs. It forces the wrong word, but it entices lots of entrepreneurs to have a whole different level of integrity. And for 30 years of working with troubled companies, you know, the lawyers or the bankers would always point fingers and say, oh, this guy's a bad guy, that girl's a bad girl. You know, maybe, but I don't ever judge anybody when their back is against the corner. And
I don't
like it. I protect against it. You saw me walk away from a deal over exactly this not so long ago, maybe a year ago now. And
absolutely.
Over exactly that. But I'm not going to judge, because these people are in a really, really difficult position.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's the thing, right? I try to be as positive and as, you know, try to, you know, be as proactive, not reactive, but proactive as possible in the obstacles that might come down the road. You know what? And I'm talking, I'm constantly dealing, working with a client on that too, as well. And they might have a capital advisor, but I sit above that.
Yeah.
You know what? With my credit folks, I'm constantly, you know what, holding hands and everything else, right, to make sure that everything's okay. And you know what? You keep that transparent line of communication open. And you know what? For somebody that has your type of courage, Scott, for example, to walk away from that particular transaction, which was a, you know, again, was a very nice transaction, but to walk away from something like that, because you're just not feeling it right. And it's just not coming together. You know what? I mean, again, that takes a lot. And folks like yourself, Scott, are like one in a million, because generally folks like yourself, you know, you do the capital advisory and the turnaround. You just want to get, you know what? You just want to get the deal. So you, not you, but some people, they just want to get it done at any cost. Well,
you walk away from big fees.
You do tremendously so. But at the same time, you have to understand when to cut bait. And you and I know that through the years, you know, of experience that we've had.
I was introduced by one of the major Canadian banks, their special loans group, years and years ago. It was actually one of the first ones that I did on the recommendation of a major bank. It was a long time ago. And the special loans officer called me up at, I think it was like 11 p.m. on a Wednesday night at home. That'll tell you something right there. You can tell them how pissed off, tell how pissed off somebody is right there. And he said, Scott, and you would know this fellow. He's a mutual friend of ours. He's in the U.S. now. And he said, Scott,
I know.
Says, I'm in this role. I've been here a little while. And there was fraud in this company. And it's being pushed over from our ABL group. And this bank, this huge bank that's you know, North America now, has never, ever, ever lost a dollar on ABL. And I'm going to be the first guy ever that lost a dollar on an ABL loan. Not that I didn't, you know, originate this or underwrite it, but I'm going to be the special loans guy whose name is beside this loss. And so the borrower, the companies come to us and said, we want to put in some equity, but we need like a little bit of time. But I don't trust these people. And what they had done originally was a fictitious accounts receivable, which might be the stupidest fraud on the face of the earth, because your best case scenario is it buys you 90 days before it drops off the borrowing base and somebody starts asking questions, right?
So never see this to amaze me.
Like, they're just the stupidity of it. Oh, anyways, long story short, I get in there as interim CFO. And I just start firing what I consider to be the bad guys, right? I fire the controller, I fire this person, I fire that person, I control 100% of cash. And the bank, I think it was a $13 million facility. And by the time everybody sharpened their pencils in the distribution business, they were looking at a recovery of like $3 million. And because, you know, the appraisals aren't the appraisals when the shit's hitting the fan. And
no, of course not.
And by the end of the summer, I think I went in May, and by September, we were down to about 4 or 5 million from 13, but we were positive on the borrowing base. So we, and we were making money.
And that's a testament to what you do.
So then I went to, and I'm just taking my monthly fee, which is de minimis. Well, it wasn't, it's not de minimis. I'm properly paid, but it wasn't, I'm not making any money on this. And then I go to one of your predecessor firms that was very active back in the day. And I sit down with the chief, and he says, okay, I'm going to do this deal, Scott, as long as you stay, because I'm not lending money to him, but I'll lend money to you. Said, okay, I'll stay as CFO. So we go through all the underwriting, we pay all the fees, we pay all the lawyers, and the bank's going to get out whole because this new lender's going to take them out. And the day before closing, I found another fraud. And I thought I got rid of all the bad guys. And this time, I caught my guy red-handed. It was him. It was the owner. And it was stupid. He rifled out 20 grand of stuff out the back door for his brother-in-law or whatever, and wrote up fictitious bills of lading and this sort of stuff. And so now I'm like, you know, every time I found a fraud all summer for the original bank, I was a hero. Now this new bank comes in and there's a fraud. I'm no longer a hero. Like, I'm the guy that brought the deal in. And
yeah, but you brought the deal in, but but that was unbeknownst. I mean, Scott, like, I mean, you kicked all the tires and it was unbeknownst to you. So, I mean,
but again, you know, I can't close and not tell the new bank.
Of course. No, of course. Right? No,
but
of course.
If I do, the company's going to sue me. And if it, there was just no win out of this. And so, so I resigned that night. And I resigned with about a 5-page resignation letter. I just like, here's everything you did all summer and that I found.
Oh.
And I said it to the company. And then I said to the new bank, I said, I resigned. So they called me up, and you know who their head underwriter was, called me up in the morning and said, so what's going on? I said, well, I don't think I could talk about this, but if I were a good underwriter, I might ask for a resignation letter. And so the deal fell apart. And what I was most worried about is that the old bank was going to say, oh, Scott screwed us, and he didn't pay us out. But the exact opposite happened. Both banks, the old one and the prospective new one, for 15 years have referred to that story and driven me tons of business, because that night I walked away from $300,000 coming to me the next day, which is the money. And anyways, that's just a hammer home.
That is integrity, my friend. That's what I'm talking about, right? Like, I mean, you have to have that courage and that integrity to do that and walk away and just say, you know what? Like, this is enough. Like, you know what? I've seen the playbook, and now you've really revealed yourself, and now I have to unfortunately step away.
It really, you know, from it really was not, I wasn't doing it as a business move. It was just me, but it was the only way I could think to get out of this problem. And,
I would have done exactly the same. I would have done exactly what you did.
It paid great dividends over my whole career, to be honest with you. Jeff, let's talk about relationship selling.
Absolutely.
And this is back out to helping salespeople, younger people in their career.
Yeah.
We talked about this a little bit before we got on. And my fear and frustration that younger generations are, they want to sell behind a screen. They want to sell through email, social media, Zoom calls. They want to sell that way, and they don't want to go out to the golf events, the drinking events, the cocktail parties, the things that we talked about before. What is your view on relationship selling?
Relationship selling. My view is, number one, you can't be a keyboard warrior. So just as you know, hiding behind a screen, as you indicated. So I mean, to me, you know, to me, relationships, it's all personal. I mean, there's a personal touch to everything. So I mean, the one thing I find about some of the younger folks who reach out to me, and they'll say, you know, for example, today, Scott, just before I got on, a LinkedIn comes in, and it's from a gentleman that I talked to in the past, I'd mentored, but he just says, hi, Jeff. You know, I don't call somebody up and say, hi, Scott, and then wait for you to say something, right? So, I mean, you know,
I get so many unsolicited LinkedIn messages and DMs, and what they say is, thanks for connecting. How are you?
It's just bizarre. So, I mean, to me, you know what? You have to use common sense, right? It's like the old school thing, Scott. Like when you and I were growing up, I mean, we didn't even have voicemail. They were like those, you know, the recording machines. So if you wanted to get a hold of whoever, you had to have them pick up the phone or go see them, right? So, I mean, we didn't have the internet then or computers and everything else. So, I mean, for me, it's all about, you know, it's the personal approach. It's being genuine. It's being yourself for me. And so I'm going to behave like myself, professional, friendly, enthusiastic, positive. Try to look for a way to get, you know, to work with that person, to instill the confidence in them that, you know what, Jeff knows what he's, yeah, he's a nice guy. I've heard that, whatever. But, you know, he really knows what he's talking about. Like, this is, you know what, this is interesting. So, you know, I'd like to go a little bit further down the road with that, you know, with Jeff. So, I mean, that's what you're really doing is you're adding value. You're planting seeds, you know, of, you know, what you know. You're not talking about, you know, like I'm doing right now. You're not talking about yourself. You're really talking about that person, what they do, and whether they're a cap, you know, whatever type of business they're in, you know what, and really trying to make, you know, make a connection there. And you're not going from zero to 60, you know, immediately. It's a, you have to build a foundation. So you have to, I can't just call somebody up at one of the large accounting firms and say, hey, I know I haven't met you before, but I'd love to, you know, what kind of deals are you guys doing and everything else? I'm telling you, it's like, Scott, you and I both know that doesn't work. Yep. So, I mean, you have to instill the confidence in them first, and you have to meet with them, let them get to know you a little bit. Talk about some examples of deals done, things that you've done in your life, you know, being at more of an active listener, which I'm trying to do, now, too, as well. And really give them, and make it an active participating, like a, make it a two-way street, not a one-way, discussion on what's going on. So being an active listener, you know, discuss, you know, what they're talking about and what interests them, circling back, and you're bringing in those different tidbits. And as well, there's a lost art to writing as well, I've noticed. So, I mean, when I get, and this goes for, you know, some younger folks and some other, you know, other people too, as well, that write me. And it's, I find it just bizarre, like the way that they'll just be, you know what I mean, with acronyms and throwing everything in. They're just not taking the time. They're not being thoughtful in terms of their delivery. So, I mean, you have to, you know, you have to take the time. Like, don't just run and go, hey, can we meet? You know, you have to compel that person to understand why you want to meet and how you're differentiating yourself from everybody else. Because again, like you said, I'm selling a product. How am I differentiating myself and our firm, Wagar, from everybody else on the street? And at the same time, I'm not disparaging those customers, those competitors of mine. I'm being, you know what? I play nice in the sandbox with everybody. So, you know what? You get known as sort of an approachable person, somebody that is approachable. Somebody that's not going to be like, yeah, you know what? I don't have time for this or whatever. And that's why Scott, for example, from a sales perspective, when I'm looking at a transaction and somebody approaches me with it and they say, and I have to say no, Scott, right? And yet you say no. But what I love doing is saying, you know, if I have to say no, I'll say no. But you can talk. I'm more than happy to introduce you or get on the phone and introduce you to this capital, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, whatever. You know what? I'll name them. Do your KYC on them quickly. Come back to me. Tell me who you want to meet, and I'll have you on the phone that day or the next day. And right. It always happens. And honest to God, Scott, I've had people say to me, well, Jeff, you know, I mean, we can, you know, pay you a finder's fee or we can do this. I don't take, number one, morally, it's ethically for me, for what I do. I will never do that. But secondly, I can't do that anyways because of the position that I'm in from a legal perspective. But having said that, I'm always giving people options of what to look at. And my reciprocity is them being happy. That's what makes me happy, is them being happy. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, like over time, like, you know, you kind of hone the skill, but it's just sort of in you, you know, I mean, to innately to be in to sort of behave in a certain way because
I think it's because what oozes out of you is benevolence, that you care about people and the goodness of things. And I heard a story a couple of years ago, which I've told a few times and written about on some of my stuff. I heard it from a psychologist on Clubhouse, and I just feel free to steal it. In that little window of 3 months when Clubhouse was hot there. And the story was, imagine Jeff, you're at work and you have a big presentation coming up and a colleague of yours says, I got it covered. I've been working hours on it. I'm all good. And you get there for that day and they put up the PowerPoint presentation on the screen and it has adding errors, typos, and it's just crap. And it's quite clear that your colleague is not competent, you know, and then the psychologist asks you to think about how you feel about that. And how you feel about that is, you know, you're disappointed, but it's not a strong emotional connection. You're just like, oh, this person's not competent. Right now, if you compare that with the same scenario, but the colleague says to you, I've worked really hard on this. I got it covered. We've had it proofread and added, and everything's like awesome. I've had 8 people sign off on it. And then they put it on the screen. Now it's clear they just lied to you, right? And how much more strongly do you feel about that versus the confidence? And I think the answer is a lot. And the reason for that is because humans value trust over competence.
So confidence is
right. So competence is the gateway. Trust is more valuable. Okay. And then
absolutely.
And then the psychologist says, now, new scenario. Jeff's best buddy takes him out and says, Jeff, you got to come with me. You got to help me. We got to move some stuff. We need to, you know, you're doing some labor here, and talks you into a scenario. Yeah. And instead takes you to some place and it's a surprise party for you. So outright lied to you, but for a good reason. Now you're excited.
Hey, that works for me.
Because we value benevolence over trust. Right. And so.
You know what? I love that you brought that up, Scott. That's so great. I think that's wonderful. Thank you.
And so if you're selling competence, you're doing it wrong. If you're selling we're trustworthy, you're doing it wrong. And what you do well is you sell benevolence, which is everything that you just said.
Thank you. And I do. You know what? It really, like, and Scott, like, I have real emotions when I'm saying no to somebody, you know, particularly deals, like transactions that I see that I see have legs to them. And, you know what, you just have to trust, you know, I mean, the folks that you work with, and you know what, sometimes they'll say, hey, you know what, I think we have to pass on this, Jeff, and allocate resources elsewhere. And you know what, hey, that's, I totally understand that. You just, you know what, there's so much pie to go around, Scott, that I just go, yep, hey, no problem, move on. But having said that, when I'm delivering that news, it is tough. Like, I mean, again, with that courage, when you're delivering that news, it is tough when you have to say no. The good thing is that with me, when I'm saying no, fortunately, I haven't taken that much time of that much of their time to come back and say no. So, I mean, that's another key, is you have to value other people's time. Absolutely. Time is a commodity.
Yep.
So, I mean, and I don't say that for myself. People can take as much time from me as possible. I hand it out. Here you go. I hand it out like cookies. I do it all the time. But having said that, I never take advantage of anybody or take for granted anybody else's their value of their time. And so that's important to me, to get back to them with a response. But I do very much, like, I have empathy. I mean, I very much feel the pain, you exactly. know what, when I have to say no. And that's why, you know, another reason why I'm positioning towards other capital providers that could likely, you know, do something a little more creative or something a little more aggressive, or, you know what, they've got an appetite, say, for something a little more sort of hairy.
Within whatever that person's offering. Jeff, as we are running to the top of the hour here,
yes, sir.
Tell us about the private debt market in Canada, U.S., or just Canada, if you prefer.
No, just touch
on that, but more importantly, WAGR, what WAGR is and its role within that market.
So WAGR was established and co-founded by Wayne Angus, who runs it now. And WAGR is a senior secured asset-based lender. And so we are a sub-advisor to Nine Point Partners. So Nine Point Partners goes out and they raise capital. So we're in their senior debt fund. So they go and raise institutional capital from high net worth individuals and high net worth families. And then that money then is provided to us to go out and act on their behalf and place it into senior secured transactions. Whether they're growing, like you mentioned, whether they're distressed, turnaround situations in a transition, whether it be from 9 months to 48 months and anything in between. And our capital is committed. So it's non-demand. So we don't wake up on the wrong side of the bed tomorrow and say, hey, you know what, we're not into technology anymore. So you know what, we're pulling out of the transaction. So that's very important for people to know too, as well, from WAGR's point of view. So our terms are generally 9 months to 48 months, anything in between. Generally, we're looking at transactions from $5 million, like that's authorized. Generally want about $4 million, $3.5 million of usage under that. And then we'll go as high as 150. Now, are we going to do 150 million? No, not at this point in time. We're likely going to hold something around probably 75, and then look to club the transaction and share it with one of our private debt partners in Canada or in the United States. So, you know, in terms of really, Scott, again, we're dealing with transition, right? So, I mean, there's a cost to that. So, I mean, we're really looking for all in return around 12%. And that's, again, all in, and that's fixed. That's not variable. So in an interest rate rising environment right now, folks that are on floating, who I feel for on variable rates, we don't have variable rates. They're fixed. So they've got a predictable cost of funds, which really works for us right now, and especially going into this economy. But WAGR for us, I mean, we've got 150 years plus years of experience in our bench. That's among the exec. I mean, the exec and then the team too as well that we work with. And I shouldn't even bifurcate that and say exec and everything else. I mean, we're a team. So, we've got a great team. We're about 12 people strong. We've got close to 20 accounts on the books. Strong AUM, strong authorized, cross border, Canadian and US. And in some cases, you know what, if it makes sense, like I've done an automotive transaction whereby they had a manufacturing facility, a stamping facility down in Mexico. We financed some of the assets down in Mexico because we were able to get our heads around that type of collateral. Similar goes with other foreign jurisdictions such as the UK and whatnot. Now, in terms of private debt in Canada, it has been a little bit of a stall period because of, we all know, with the bridging finance fallout, with that entire fallout, that really posed a real challenge for a lot of the private debt folks in Canada, because you, not so much the institutional investors, it was the high net worth individuals and the family offices, because they started running. It was like there was a tire fire. They just started running for the, everyone started running for the exits, and pulling money out. So capital raising is definitely on is the biggest thing right now, is really raising capital. And the good thing with WAGR is we not only have that capital available to us, but we also have a leverage line now from a U.S. lender, which is excellent from that perspective of not having to deal with cash drag, where we have to pull funds from, say, Nine Point, and then we're sitting on money. We don't have that issue anymore.
Right.
So we've got the leverage line which we can use for that too as well. So that's really good. But that is one of the challenges right now for private debt lenders in Canada from that perspective. And that's even for the most, storied, experienced teams that are out there, is in terms of, capital, that's readily and available. And I think Q1, Q2, 23, I think is really going to be a big pickup. Particularly with institutional lenders in Canada. The U.S. is so highly liquid. It's just unbelievable. Like, the U.S. just blows me away with what they can do. And especially, now having said that, they've always been sort of the leaders in liquidity and sort of the price, the stalking horses of what's going on. So I see that being a challenge for us and some of our competitors as well, as the U.S. opens up more and they start bringing more lending into Canada, like people boots on the ground in Canada.
Think it's going to go the other way? Aren't we at the time of the cycle where they're going to start retracting?
No, I think they're like, you would think that a little bit. But I do know like Sienna's opened up a shop up here with Wayne, which is fantastic. And it's out of Stamford, Connecticut. And Dwayne will do a great job for Sienna, which is excellent. And they're a really good player out of the States. And then you've got like folks like Ares, Ares Capital. They've got folks coming up here like Lawrence Chua, Wingspire, Whitehawk, White Oak. I mean, some of these folks, SLR is massive, the old Crystal Capital Financial guys. So, I mean, I do see eventually, maybe it won't be this year, obviously, but next year I could see some U.S. players.
Okay, but historically, and you would know this because you were the Canadian guy for U.S. banks.
Yeah, well,
right.
The US,
so, but you, but if the U.S. hits a recession, which I think is just guaranteed, and coupled with that is credit restriction, which I think is guaranteed, the first thing to go from a U.S. bank's perspective is the Canadian operations.
Scott, I totally agree with you on that perspective, 100%, absolutely. So, going back on what I was saying, I see that, absolutely. And I dealt with that because being a Canadian, like working for a U.S. bank in Canada, it's great. It's a privilege. It's an honor to work for a great U.S. bank. And there's incredible U.S. institutions that I've worked for. But having said that, you are, if you're a business developer and I'm going up against somebody like a Bank of Montreal or CIBC or somebody, they're going to kill me every time, because any smart CFO or controller is going to say to you, or a smart owner is going to say, well, once things start to go, even in a good environment, once things start to go sideways, are we, Jeff, we know we're not dealing with you because you're the business development guy. Are we going to be dealing with John Smith, who's on your credit team, or are we going to be dealing with an American down in Chicago or New York or Cleveland or wherever have you, or Pittsburgh? And that's generally the case. So it's a whole new, it opens up a whole new world for
us. It's very cycle dependent. I remember, I think my very first significant ABL deal I ever placed in my life when I was in my 20s. And we were doing a roadshow for a company that had rental equipment for the movie industry in Canada, one of the top ones in the country. And we had all the ABL, and there was no trouble on this at all. This was a high growth, great company. So all the main banks would pitch when they did, and they all came in and they talked about ABLs, but they also talked about relationship management and how we're here and we're going to look after you, like you just said. And then GE came up from Connecticut. And the dude walked in the door and he said, I don't want a relationship with you. And my client was you. I want you. Just give me the money. I always remember that. It's cycle dependent.
If you've got a cross-border, if you've got cross-border capabilities, then you're in a good, and you've got a prospective borrower has got a Canadian sub or a Canadian parent or vice versa, down in the States and everything else, it works really well.
Yeah,
if it's a Canada-only deal, you better be bringing a shotgun. If you're a U.S. lender to the party, because it's gonna be
hard.
You're gonna get slaughtered because everyone else can price down, right? Because you're getting the ancillary income and everything else. Where you're not getting the treasury management and all everything else. So absolutely.
Scott. Okay, so Waygar, if you're in Canada or the U.S. you have assets in manufacturing, technology, whatever industry, but if you have some assets and you're looking to borrow a minimum of, say, $5 million, a high of $100, $150 million, and your all-in cost of capital is going to be around 12%, which means that you're not able to borrow at the 6%, 8% lenders because you've got high growth, you're going through a transition, you have a story that you need to tell, Jeff is the guy to call.
Thank you, Scott.
Is that right?
Covenant Light, and I like to look at it, Scott, as a friendly wallet.
There you go. Okay, Jeff, this is the Winning Momentum podcast, where we talk about strategies to turn around a business, turn around your life when things aren't going as expected. What would be your three pieces of advice, strategies to change momentum?
Wow. I would think, three strategies. Stay to your true self. Stay to your true self. Knowledge, understand what you're talking about and understand what you're selling. And if you don't understand something, say, I don't understand this, and ask the question. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Absolutely. And third strategy again, I guess, courage, have the courage to deal with things, in a professional friendly way, and don't be afraid, don't be afraid to say no. I sort of got stumped on that one. You stumped me, which is good, but I like it.
Excellent.
But I would say, that's what I would say, though, from a strategic point of, and always keep striving for growth. Like, I mean, you always, it's so funny, Scott. I started working when I was 12 years old. I started working at McDonald's. I don't know if that's the legal age anymore, but I was always in customer service. And they say, if you got time to lean, you have time to clean, which means that, the devil has, the devil has work for idle hands to do, right? So, if you're not, you can always be busy doing things and researching and looking and reading up and gaining new knowledge on what's going on, everything else. Don't be lazy. That's the other thing, right? Is be proactive, not reactive. Don't be lazy. That's really important. Take the time to understand who your prospective borrower is or who you're going to be facing with. Do some research before you reach out to somebody and understand who they are. You know what? It goes a long way, and it doesn't take much time.
Excellent. Anything else we want to discuss, Jeff, before we sign off?
No, I could go on forever.
I told you I'd had about 10 minutes of content, and here we are an hour and 10 minutes into it, and I skipped three quarters of it.
Scott, I just want to thank you for inviting me on, Scott, and you're the consummate gentleman and scholar as always. And I very much look forward to working with you as always.
On that point, I would personally like to thank put a word out for the Waygar guys. I think in this business, they're a fantastic group of people, as
they are.
You've seen in Jeff, but also in Wayne and Aaron and the rest of the crowd there. They do a great job. People. And so no risk calling them for sure. And
absolutely.
Thank you to the audience. Thank you for listening. This has been the Winning Momentum Podcast with my guest, Jeffrey Hiscock. And what else? I will talk to you all next week. Please give us a thumbs up. We're available on YouTube, thescottsinclair.com, and everywhere that you listen to podcasts. See you later. Thanks for joining me, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.